Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Today, I am delighted to be talking with several people who are here in the cafe and joining us by phone about the Western Climate Initiative. Sandra Ely is the Environment and Energy Policy Coordinator for the New Mexico Environment Department, and Jim Norton is the Director of the Environmental Protection Division at the New Mexico Environment Department, and he's the chair of the Western Climate Initiative Reporting Committee. We'll find out what all that means in just a few minutes. Sarah Cottrell is the Energy and Environment Policy Advisor for Governor Richardson, and joining us by phone, David Tunderman, who's an environmental lawyer with Parsons, Bailey, and Latimer in Salt Lake City, and he's a fellow in the American College of Environmental Lawyers and is also involved in the Western Climate Initiative. Welcome, everybody, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
It's great to be here.
It's great to have all of you here. So, first of all, let's talk about why it's important to discuss climate change in the first place, namely the dangers to our state, our country, and our world if we don't deal with it.
Well, we are especially at risk here in New Mexico because of the effects of climate change on our water supply. Obviously, with hotter temperatures, that's going to cause and is already causing reduced snowpack in the mountains. And then, of course, when that snowpack melts, it comes off quicker, and there's less water available in our rivers and streams later in the season. We're also going to experience, and already are, more forest fires, more extreme weather conditions, and that means more droughts and floods. We've already seen significant floods just recently in southern New Mexico, in Hatch, and in Ruidoso, and serious problems for the ecology of our, especially of our mountains in New Mexico. So we're really vulnerable here in New Mexico. A lot of people think often that the biggest effects will be the result of rising sea levels for our coastal areas, but I think here in New Mexico, we're especially vulnerable to climate change.
As probably many of our listeners are aware, the rest of the world, to some extent, has kind of been ahead of the United States in dealing with climate change. What are some of the international initiatives, and what has or has not been the United States' participation in them?
So international action on climate change dates all the way back to 1992 to the Earth Summit in Brazil in Rio de Janeiro. And the U.S. became a signatory to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change at that time with the goal of stabilizing greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere. 5 years later, they negotiated the Kyoto Treaty in Japan. The U.S. took on binding greenhouse gas reduction targets. And then the wheels kind of came off. And when President Bush became president, he withdrew the United States from the Kyoto Treaty, and we really haven't seen any progress at the national level since. Congress has debated some bills, but we haven't seen anything pass either chamber of commerce of Congress yet, and we haven't seen a national program.
And a new verb was invented, the verb unsign, as in to unsign a treaty.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, they basically said that they would continue to negotiate on the framework convention itself, but that we would not commit to our Kyoto target.
So, on a national level, what, again, has and hasn't been done in terms of, I mean, the last couple of years, there has been some movement on climate change.
Certainly the debate has moved forward. Massachusetts versus EPA is an important Supreme Court case that established that greenhouse gases are air pollutants subject to regulation under existing law. And President Obama supports cap-and-trade legislation and has appointed a number of great people to his administration who understand the need for climate action. So we're optimistic, but we're not sure yet how quickly they'll move in this new administration on climate change.
So as a result of the non-action or sluggish action in the United States, some regional initiatives have come into being, and one of them is the Western Climate Initiative, but that has some precedents, including here in New Mexico. Governor Richardson signed an executive order about, what, 4 years ago, was it?
That's right. Governor Richardson really kicked off the state's work on climate change in 2005 when he signed an executive order. And there were several things in the executive order that he directed us at the Environment Department to do. One was that he set aggressive emission reduction targets for us here in the state, and then formed an advisory group to make recommendations about how to meet those aggressive emission reduction targets. He also directed us to do a study of what the effects of climate change are in New Mexico that we talked about a few moments ago, and then also directed us to prepare an inventory of the emissions so that we know where those emissions come from in New Mexico.
So what is the history of the Western Climate Initiative?
So as we talked about, in the absence of federal leadership on climate change, states are taking the lead, and ultimately we all recognize that we need a national program, but we're not willing to wait to see what's going to happen because the science of climate change is irrefutable. So in February of 2007, Governor Richardson and four Western governors signed an MOU creating the Western Climate Initiative.
Signed a what?
A memorandum of understanding, creating the WCI, the Western Climate Initiative. And the main objective of this initiative is to develop a Western regional greenhouse gas cap and trade program to help meet a regional goal of reducing emissions by 15% below 2005 levels by 2020.
15% below 2005 levels. That's significant.
It is significant. It's a good start. Some would argue that it's not as much as we need according to the science, but we have to start. We have to start making reductions, and we'll certainly need to ratchet that number down over time. But we feel like this is a good starting point.
So are there other programs in the United States of this kind? The Western is one thing. There are also Midwestern programs and so on?
Yeah, that's right. We aren't alone in this effort. In the absence of federal action, many of the states have moved forward to look at cap-and-trade programs. There's the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative in the Northeast that consists of 10 Northeast states, and their program is really just electric utilities. But they're ahead of us because they've already started. They started their auction last fall. They've started their program in January, and so we're looking to their experience, learning from their experience as we move forward with the WCI. There is also the Midwestern states, too, under the Midwestern Core that have started a program, too, but they don't actually have a program up and running. They're in the development phase, and they're looking to us, to see what happens with the WCI, I think, before they get going.
The WCI is the Western Climate Initiative, about which we are talking this whole hour today on the Radio Cafe. So it's an interesting combination of executive and legislative action that is going on here, and one that really requires, I think, more understanding on the part of citizens than maybe we have. So the governor says, yes, we are signing on to the WCI, but then legislators who are voted in by us and who are, in theory, guided by us have to actually make the details of it happen. And there is legislation right now pending in front of this legislature.
That's correct. The proposal is called the New Mexico Global Warming Solutions Act. It's sponsored by Representative Ben Rotifer, and it provides the state's Environmental Improvement Board with the added authority to fully implement the Western Climate Initiative program. Under the proposal, the EIB is what we call this board, could establish a greenhouse gas trading program, including the auctioning of emission allowances and the establishment of an offset program and recognition of early emission reductions. It does put constraints on the EIB in establishing the program, and it asks them to take a look at things like the costs and benefits to the state of the program, considering impacts on low-income communities, competitive issues, and the size of the allowance market, that kind of thing. But it provides them the authority to move forward and take the time we need to implement a solid program.
So in the absence of legislative action, the Western Climate Initiative, it can't do anything.
Well, that's not completely true. The states and provinces, there are 11 of them that are part of the Western Climate Initiative, have a variety of different existing underlying laws. And for us here in New Mexico, the legislature has already granted to the Environmental Improvement Board the authority to regulate air pollution. And global warming pollution is a form of air pollution. So if it's a smokestack here in New Mexico that's emitting pollution, the legislature has already granted authority to the EIB to do those regulations. However, if the source of pollution is in another state and then it's imported into New Mexico, for example, through a power line or something of that nature, then there is additional legislative authority needed. Also, the WCI is recommending a trading program, including auctioning of allowances to emit greenhouse gases, and that's another thing that there's legislative authority needed for. So the Global Warming Solutions Act that Sarah mentioned a minute ago will be addressing those areas where the existing legislative authority doesn't exist yet. And there are quite different situations among all the different 11 partners. For example, California has a very broad bill that grants the authority in effect for all of this already. Some of the Canadian provinces have the same, and then other states are in different situations.
Who's in the Western Climate Initiative?
Well, there are, you know, there were originally just the five states, and since that time, since California first joined, Oregon, Washington, Arizona, and New Mexico first founded it, the states of Utah and Montana have joined, and four Canadian provinces, British Columbia, Ontario, Quebec.
Oddly, Quebec is not really in the West.
That's right. Well, and neither is Ontario. It's pretty far east. And Manitoba.
Right.
Those four Canadian provinces represent 80% of the economy in Canada. So their participation is significant. And the seven states represent about 20% of the U.S. economy. So that's significant as well.
So let's talk to David Tunderman for a moment, who is joining us from Utah, one of the states that signed on to the Western Climate Initiative. What are the advantages and disadvantages to having a regional climate initiative?
Well, I think the states and the regions have historically been good policy laboratories to develop and implement environmental programs, and they provide essential resources to implementing environmental programs, and that's been true in other environmental areas such as clean air and clean water and so forth. But at the same time, there's a real advantage to national consistency to avoid anti-competitive cross-border and interstate impacts, and it appears that federal legislation is coming and is coming quickly. I think Senator Boxer has promised Senate action prior to the Copenhagen conference next December. And as Jim pointed out, many of the Western states need additional legislation to move forward to implementation, so that while the three regional initiatives are terrific policy laboratories, and I think ought to continue to develop programs because it will give those states and regions a head start in implementing federal legislation. Yet still, the advantages of national consistency seem to argue for pushing ahead with federal legislation and then using the regional programs as a head start on implementing the new federal program, which is certainly coming.
And it does seem that there's one great big loophole, namely, for example, let's say somebody wants to put a coal plant in New Mexico. We have climate legislation that makes it economically less favorable for them to do that. Then they go over the border, they do it in Texas, that they're not part of it, and they import energy from there. We haven't solved anything.
Yeah, that's right. Leakage is an issue that has to be addressed, that you will get whether it's a regional program or a national program, because you can have international leakage, and it's something we need to hit head on. Now, the broader the scope of the program, the more sources included, the less likely there will be leakage. And that's one reason that we want to address imported power, not just the smokestack, as Director Norton mentioned, but the importation of power into the state. So under the WCI design, and what we're seeking legislative authority for, is the ability to require the first recipient of that power as it comes into the state to hold allowances. So if you have a desert rock that gets constructed, or Four Corners that sends power into New Mexico because they're on Indian land, not in our jurisdiction, the first recipient of that power would have to hold allowances. So we will be able to address that power, and just because they're outside the state doesn't mean they won't be affected by the program.
Could you explain the concept of cap and trade and, for example, the term allowances, what that even means?
Yeah, that's right. A cap and trade really is the most economical way to address greenhouse gas emission reductions. You set your cap, but you let industry determine how they get there.
So a cap means there is a limit that in the state of New Mexico or in the region or in the world, there is X amount of greenhouse gases that may be emitted and not one bit more.
That's right. And then it declines over time, so you get those emission reductions. And you require industry to hold an allowance or a ton of carbon. An allowance is a permit to emit that ton of carbon for every ton they've emitted. This isn't new to them because they've never had to be accountable for those emissions before. They've just been able to emit them, and now they have to pay for them. So that also gets the emission reductions. But one of the really nice things about it is it lets industry decide how they get that emission reduction. It provides them more flexibility than they normally have under a command and control type scenario, which is how we regulated air pollution in the past. So we say, this is how far you got to get your emission reductions down to. They determine how they get there. And if they go beyond what's required by the law, then they can sell those allowances to somebody else. So if they can do it cheaply, they sell it to somebody who has higher abatement costs. And that's why the program is economical. It also drives innovation because industry uses their best minds to get those emission reductions because there's money associated with that. And it also creates linkages internationally, like with the REGI program or the European program.
Let's say a coal plant decides to plant 10,000 acres worth of trees in the rainforest. Do they get credit for that?
Potentially, yeah. That's what we call an offset. An offset is an emission reduction that occurs outside of the cap sector. So since forestry is not in our program, it's outside the program. Now, there's a lot of concern about offsets. They have to be real, verifiable, they have to be permanent, they have to be enforceable, and so we're establishing a very robust offset program so that those sources outside the cap can also have incentives to reduce. In New Mexico, some of those offset programs would affect agriculture. So we've got, say, dairy waste or methane production from these dairies. If they can reduce that methane reduction, turn it into power, they'll get money for that. It'll also include landfills. If there's methane loss related to those landfills, if they capture that, then they could get money for that as well. So we're encouraging offsets. We think it's a great way to get additional emission reductions.
If I might interject here, Mary,
yes.
Charlotte, one of the ways to keep the costs down of a cap-and-trade system is to take Sarah's point, and expand it as broadly as possible, because the larger the potential offset market, both from out-of-state and even out-of-country sources, and credits for early reduction, people who can reduce their emissions early on, the more flexibility there is in allowing offsets and early reduction credits, the lower the overall cost will be, because the company subject to the reduction can go outside and even can go to Mexico or someplace else to find cheaper ways to achieve its CO2 emissions.
How is the data collected that tells us in the first place how many tons of stuff industries are putting into the air in the first place?
Well, this is something that we here in New Mexico have been working on a lot, and then also through the Western Climate Initiative Reporting Committee. It's very important for the measurement of the emissions to be accurate, because this will be translated into costs later, and as Sandra mentioned, tradable units. So we need to know what the amount of pollution is that's being emitted from each source. And so we have developed a really quite rigorous process of measuring the emissions from each of the types of emission sources. And we have released many drafts of this overall mandatory reporting document, and it will be completed in the next month or two. And one of the things that we're also finding is very important is we have to do this the same. In other words, we can't here in New Mexico measure emissions in one way and then have industry in British Columbia measure emissions in a different way, because it can translate into millions of dollars in economic value that either benefits or harms one of the states. So we've been working together among all the 11 partners to make the reporting system harmonized, and so we, each state and province, will then adopt as regulations those reporting requirements, and we'll know that a ton is a ton in each of the states and provinces that are part of WCI.
And who goes around? What authority is it that goes around with their devices and measures carbon coming out of smokestacks or whatever?
Well, there are many different ways that this happens. For example, in a utility, they can actually measure the number of tons coming out of a smokestack. It's more complicated in some factory settings and in some other situations where the emissions are more difficult to quantify, but we're using the best available methods that can be used in order to do that.
David, I think that part of the concern of your clients, and you have clients who are extractive industries, mining and oil and gas, and people who have really traditionally tried to block environmental legislation of all kinds. How are they dealing with all of this?
I think that most realistic or many realistic companies look at the Massachusetts v. EPA decision that Sarah mentioned, which points toward using the Clean Air Act as a way to regulate climate emissions, which is a very poor tool for accomplishing that. So I think realistic and practical industries realize that new federal legislation is needed because the existing laws are such a poor tool. I'd like to underscore the importance of what Jim said regarding accurate measurements, and note that for quite a number of industries and source categories, adequate methods for measuring emissions are not yet available. So there, while quite a bit of good work has been done, there remains quite a bit of good work to be done in order to develop reliable measuring techniques for these gases.
What are the industries that we're even talking about? Who in New Mexico, in the West, is really giving off the bulk of greenhouse gases?
Well, the governor did require us to do an inventory. And what we found in New Mexico is that the largest source of emissions is from electric utilities, largely the big coal plants in the state. Second for us is the oil and gas industry. There is a significant amount of carbon dioxide that's mixed in with the natural gas, in particularly in the northwest part of the state, and that CO2 is vented into the atmosphere. There are also emissions of the natural gas, which is methane, and which is a very potent greenhouse gas as well. And then the third biggest source for us in New Mexico is transportation, cars and trucks, et cetera. And we're a little different from nationally. Transportation nationally is the second largest source, but for us it's third because of the big emissions in the oil and gas industry.
So are we, for example, drivers part of this?
Not directly. The WCI program starts out in 2012 with the large utilities, the electric utilities, and other large sources of emissions in factories, for example. Later in 2015, the program brings in transportation fuels, but the regulation will not happen at each person's car, but rather at choke points where the transportation fuels enter commerce. So you can think of it as being like the end of a pipeline where the gasoline is transported from the pipeline into trucks that then head off to gas stations. So that would be the point of regulation for transportation fuels, and then similarly for residential and commercial fuels, natural gas, for example, would also be regulated at choke points like the end of a natural gas pipeline.
So what we're talking about, the Western Climate Initiative cap and trade programs that would affect New Mexico and states throughout the West and Canada. What would be the penalties if, for example, an electric power plant said, well, we just aren't going to comply with this and we'll pay the penalties? In other words, what makes it, how strong do the penalties have to be for them to actually say we're going to comply?
Well, you know, we have our standard penalty structure in New Mexico already under the Air Quality Control Act that allows us to collect $15,000 a day per violation. But we need to be consistent across the region, and that may not match up with the other provinces or states. We don't want to have weaker enforcement in one state than another. So we all agreed that to have a 3-to-1 coverage. What that means is that an entity must have sufficient allowances to cover their emissions at the end of the compliance period. If they don't, they pay 3 times the market price for every allowance or every ton they are missing. And we think that will be sufficient to get compliance. A 3-to-1 penalty is pretty good. It's what the RGGI states are doing, and it's what the WCI will be doing. Now, the states can go above and beyond that, too. I mean, there may be appropriate times to do that. If you have somebody who blatantly violates the law and continues to do so, we can, you know, ratchet it up. But the 3-to-1 is the minimum through the WCI.
Is there any kind of incentive whereby an electric utility that was about to build a coal plant would say, you know, we think we're just going to, instead of extracting coal, put solar panels over a very big sunny area?
Well, you know, we don't have incentives for a facility that's not going to be emitting, you know, a new facility.
Right.
I mean, we have incentives for, put in solar or wind or geothermal and other, say, tax credits. But in this program, if you already have an existing plant, say the San Juan plant, and they decide to reduce now rather than wait until the program starts, we will make sure that they get credit for that. That's
right.
The early reduction credits. And David mentioned that earlier. It's very important to industry because there are industries right now who are moving ahead and reducing their greenhouse gas emissions, shrinking their carbon footprint, and we want to reward that because we want that to happen. So the WCI design does account for that.
If I could add to that, in this legislative session, we've got a couple of bills, even in this tight environment, to try to provide financial incentives to companies that are going to make investments in renewable energy, especially solar, dairy, biomass, those kinds of industries. So we're trying to complement the Western Climate Initiative framework with other policies and other tax incentives and structures that help incentivize the type of investments we want to see in our state.
And hopefully the administration's new stimulus bill will provide additional incentives for investment in renewables to use as offsets or reduction credits in this program.
We're talking to Sandra Ely and Jim Norton from the New Mexico Environment Department, Sarah Cottrell from Governor Richardson's office, and David Tunderman, environmental lawyer from Utah. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned to KSFR. We're talking about the Western Climate Initiative here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. So when we talk about cap and trade programs, something which is very important is how high or low to set the cap. In other words, how much greenhouse gas may be emitted by all the greenhouse gas emitters in the West or wherever the region is you're talking about. And then how is that lowered over time? And are those decisions based on science or are they based purely on politics?
Well, you know, it's actually also based on what we think we can do, which is kind of a combination of both. You know, this program starts in 2012, and the cap in 2012 will be used or will be developed using our best estimates of what those emissions are going to be, and we're going to have to develop them in 2010 to give industry a heads up. Some states will have numerous emission reductions before then. Some will have a lot of growth. So we'll include all of that when doing those estimates. And then there's kind of this straight line trajectory of 15% below 2005 levels by 2020, which will be the endpoint, and that's where we're headed.
And the science is telling us that by the middle of the century, we need to have a 75 or 80% reduction in emissions. And as you may have noticed, really for many years, even decades, the science has become more and more clear. And each time there's another scientific study that comes out, it shows that the situation is even worse than they thought.
Right.
And so we really need to get on this trajectory toward a significant reduction by the middle of the century. And we think that the WCI targets beginning of 15% cut by 2020 is a good start toward that. We need to get on that trajectory, but we need to continue beyond 2020 to have additional significant emission reductions.
It seems like if you were to look at the graph showing what is necessary by when, and then you were to look at the graph showing the speed at which people, especially politicians, change their mind and get on the program, they look really different.
They really do, and we don't have a lot of time to get a handle on this problem. And unfortunately, the emissions that have already been put into the atmosphere, even if, and of course this isn't going to happen, even if we were to somehow stop all our emissions tomorrow, still there would be residual effects of the greenhouse gas pollution that's already been put into the atmosphere. But what we hope we can do, what we are confident we can do, is to head off the really catastrophic effects of climate change if we're able to quickly begin to reduce our emissions and continue that through the decades.
I imagine that industry is very worried about the economic impacts on them. And of course, if it's a utility, they're going to pass those economic impacts straight on to us for turning on our lights. It'll cost twice or three times or 10 times as much or whatever. How are we as a society dealing with that?
Well, you know, it's an issue that's on the mind of a lot of people. You know, how do we address the economic impacts of this program? And it's on the mind of the WCI, too. And so we designed this program very carefully to help contain costs to industries and the consumers. As David mentioned earlier, things like early emission reductions help do that. A robust offset program is really important to that. And then the free distribution of allowances, rather than selling every ton, but distributing some for free, will also help keep costs down, both to the consumer and to industry.
Wait, free distribution of allowances, meaning, here, you can emit a ton of carbon without paying for it.
That's right.
But how does that help the global warming situation?
Well, they're still under the cap. They still have to reduce. There still is a cost for purchasing some of those allowances. Let me back up just a little bit. There's a few ways you can distribute allowances to industry. One is to auction. One is to freely allocate. One is just pay a price rather than auctioning it. In the WCI design, we settled on a 10% minimum auction for the first part of the program.
10% minimum auction, what does that mean?
Of the total allowances that are out there. So for New Mexico, we have maybe 45 million metric tons. If we auction 10% of that, that's 4.5 million metric tons that would be auctioned. And the rest could be freely distributed or auctioned or sold or however. So a 10% is what the minimum will be.
So you have a group of utility people standing in a room with paddles and say, I'll pay $5.
Well, we're establishing the auction right now, or the auction design right now. And we're looking at the European auction, the REGI auction, Australia's designed an auction. So we're looking at different ways to set up that auction. And the auction will probably start in 2011. So there's a good reason to have both free allocation and auction. The European market has been mostly free auction, and they're moving more towards, free allocation, and moving more towards auction now. You need it to set the price. You need it to help provide incentive. But, you know, I believe that ramping up the auction amount is the right way to go, especially for industries that aren't used to paying for those emission allowances. If you're paying $20 a ton and you've got 10 million metric tons, you know, that's a lot of money to an industry. So I think bringing them into it gradually is a good thing. So
I'd like to underscore that point. In order to create a phase-in period and in order to keep the overall increases in energy costs at a reasonable level for consumers, that certainly in the early years, allocating allowances freely makes a lot more economic sense than a heavy-handed auction policy.
Sometimes when we look at situations wherein multinational U.S.-based oil companies make profits that are so staggeringly huge, and their profits are coming from individual citizens paying higher costs for that energy. I mean, that must factor into it as well. Is there a way to put a cap on, I mean, you can't really put a cap on their profits.
No, we can't put a cap on their profits. And I think some industries, I want to point out related to just that point, some industries are more conducive to receive free allocations than others. In New Mexico, we have a regulated utility environment where electricity is heavily regulated by the PRC. And so we feel more comfortable providing free allocations to utilities. And that's what is in the Global Warming Solutions Act that is over at the Capitol right now. But for other industries, it may not be necessary to give them free allocations. Now, there's this whole competitive issue, too, you know. So if you've got sources that are leaving the state because they don't want to be regulated because they're concerned about the cost, if we firmly believe that there is a competitive issue there, then those would also be sources where we might want to freely allocate. So there's a lot to look at when you freely allocate or auction and make those and determine who gets the free allocations and who has to purchase their allowances through auction.
Yeah, Sarah had mentioned quite a bit earlier the importance of the leakage problem. Free allowances mitigates that leakage problem significantly because it would mitigate important cost differences between like a refinery in Utah or New Mexico on the one hand and a refinery in someplace like Nebraska or Iowa on the other. So allowing free allowances would dampen the price differences for consumers in the WCI states versus consumers in states that are outside the WCI jurisdictions.
Right, right. Now, we have this bill introduced by Congressman Roedefer in the House here in the New Mexico legislative session right now. I think it's Bill 653.
That's correct.
And what is at stake in terms of passing this bill during this legislative session?
Well, New Mexico is an important state in all of this, especially in the Western Climate Initiative. Even though we're not the biggest in terms of the population, we are the first oil and gas state to comprehensively address climate change, and that presents a unique set of challenges for us. So while it wouldn't be ideal if we didn't get the bill, ideally we would get the bill this year, we would be able to spend the next couple of years putting a responsible program in place that tracks the Western Climate Initiative. That would be ideal. If we don't get the bill through this year, it won't derail New Mexico's participation. We'll continue to participate and work with our partners in the Western Climate Initiative and to work with the Obama administration on program design at the regional and the national levels. And we'll try again with the bill next year if we don't get it this year.
And so if the Obama administration is successful in doing, for example, a national cap and trade program of the kind that the WCI is talking about, but really doing an aggressive and effective cap and trade program on a national level, what would happen to the regional programs?
We've built into our bill for New Mexico that our program would sunset, that it would go away if the federal government implemented a program of equal or greater stringency to what we're planning on doing, because we really do prefer a national program. But in the absence of that, as we've talked about, you know, the whole time, we can't delay. So that's how we've set it up in New Mexico to address that problem.
Do you have a sense of how legislators and how the public are responding to this issue?
I think there's a difference between those two. The public
is
responding.
What? You mean the public is not perfectly represented by its legislators?
Well, the public is very concerned about climate change. And, of course, in the recent financial crisis, public priorities have shifted some toward financial issues. But there's still overwhelming support among the public for addressing climate change in a serious way, and polls specifically say they want their governments to do more to aggressively address climate change, and we did see through 8 years of the Bush administration at the federal level that there really just wasn't the motivation within the federal administration, and that's why these regional initiatives have popped up. Here in New Mexico, we're hopeful that the Global Warming Solutions Act will pass this year, but we do recognize that it's an uphill battle.
So when you talk about the public and the legislators not exactly lining up, what kind of objections are you seeing to climate change and environmental legislation in general within the legislature?
Well, this has been a tough year for environmental legislation in the New Mexico legislature, and there's been a lot of backlash.
Really?
It has. I mean, it's sort of surprising because some of the new faces in the legislature, are great environmentalists and want to support us on some of these initiatives. But it has been a hard year. We've seen a lot of bills that oppose some of the regulations that we've adopted over the last 6 years. We're seeing just a backlash to some of that. And it's especially tough in a year when the economy is not doing very well. Unfortunately, a lot of times we see people turn to the environmental regulations as their number one cause of the problem, and that's not really fair, but that does happen.
I think the leakage issue highlights some of the legislative concern, Mary Charlotte, in as much as legislators are concerned about jobs being exported out of state as a result of climate and other regulations.
And just to reiterate, leakage means that if you have a regulatory environment in one area and not in another area, we even have that in Santa Fe City versus Santa Fe County, where people are worried that jobs will go into the county because we implement a minimum wage, and that turns out not to really have been that much of a problem, but people are very concerned about it.
I think it's important to recognize that addressing climate change is not anti-business. We stand side by side with a lot of industry in this global fight. We fully support, there's a coalition of environmental groups and industry giants that are pushing for a federal program. And, we think that's great. It shows a lot of leadership. The insurance industry is at the forefront of these efforts in part because the companies are going to have to pay the future flood claims if sea levels rise and that kind of thing. And business hates uncertainty. And the sooner we can get, solid programs in place to address climate change, everybody, I think, realizes it's coming. We just need to design it, put it in place, provide that certainty, and move ahead with addressing the problem rather than continuing to fight about the minutiae.
I do think that it's also really important to point out the economic impact of doing nothing. When your rivers dry up, you don't have tourism. When your rivers dry up, you don't have water to go into our tap to make new houses that people can live in. I mean, there's gigantic, just on a state level, not to mention the implications of terrorism and losing, all the coastal cities in the world, of not doing anything about climate change.
I think that's right, and the costs of inaction are really substantially higher than the costs of acting. The problem, though, is that those costs are, the significant costs are further into the future, and so often we tend to just focus on the immediate problems right in front of us and ignore those longer-term problems. But there have been a number of studies around the world about the cost of inaction, and it's staggering.
There's another issue that is not directly related to the Western Climate Initiative, but it does speak to the question of delaying. There is an act that would affect the use of, what is it, emission standards, clean cars?
Yeah, that's correct. Environmental Improvement Board, the board that passes most of our environmental regulations in the state, in 2007 adopted the California Clean Car Standards. At that time, there were just a handful of states that have done it. Now there are about 14 states that represent half the market in vehicles in the country that have adopted the standards.
What does it mean to have clean car standards?
Well, these standards do a few things. One, they address greenhouse gases. In fact, we expect to have vehicles in 2016 that will emit 30% fewer greenhouse gases. But not only that, it addresses other pollutants that come from tailpipes, like particulates and toxics and pollution that causes ozone. And it has this technology forcing piece of it called a zero emission vehicle that is also moving forward. Unfortunately, there is a proposal, a couple proposals now in our state legislature to delay this. The program is supposed to start in 2011, but industry would like it to start in 2015. And so we're quite concerned about that. We think it'd be difficult to meet our greenhouse gas emission reduction target, and we also think it's not the right thing to do right now when we've got ozone levels in the state that are exceeding public health standards.
Is that right?
Yes.
So what if you had clean car standards, then people, I mean, where I came from Massachusetts before I lived here, and that I moved here a really long time ago, and even then you had to have an inspection sticker that said that where they measured what was coming out of your tailpipe, and if you didn't pass, you didn't get a sticker.
Well, you won't have to do that with this program, with the Clean Car Standard. The responsibility for the program lies solely on the manufacturers. They have to deliver to the state cars that meet these specific standards.
Okay.
So it doesn't mean that the emission program that's in Bernalillo County right now will expand throughout the state. It really falls on the manufacturers.
So basically, if we just all keep on driving our 1972 pickup trucks, nothing will ever change.
Well, those are exempt. It's only for new vehicles that are coming into the state. And you know, the idea is that they will eventually die and get off the road, though it seems like in New Mexico they live forever.
It's because they don't rust.
Right.
So we've got a couple of minutes left. I just want to give Sarah and give each of you a moment to talk about anything that you would like our listeners to know about climate change, particularly what our listeners really can do, how they can be active in supporting climate change legislation in New Mexico and in getting involved in general.
Well, I would, thanks for the opportunity to speak to that. I would encourage everybody to contact your legislators and help educate them about the need for climate change legislation and encourage them to vote for our bill, for House Bill
653,
and support Representative Roedefer. This is a really important piece of legislation, probably one of the most important ones that the governor has this year on environment. You know, I just thought I would reflect a little bit. I graduated from college in 2001, and I was in Bonn, Germany, for the negotiations on the Kyoto Protocol, the year that the U.S. had pulled out and the rest of the world moved forward.
Good heavens.
And it was really sad and astonishing. And there I was, you know, hoping that they would do it, but really upset that one of the world's biggest polluting nations was not part of it. The biggest polluting nation, responsible for a quarter of the world's greenhouse gas emissions that are up in the atmosphere right now. And so it's one of the things that's motivated me to come, you know, in New Mexico to work on this and to work on this at an international level, which is what we're doing through the Western Climate Initiative. This is a U.S. and Canada effort with Mexican states observing, and it's a very important model. It shows that we can work together and implement a program like this and serve as a model for the nation and for the world, and hopefully get the U.S. back on track to participate internationally.
I would add that it is equally important that the fastest growing developing nations, such as China and India and Brazil, also be a target of U.S. policy, so that any reductions achieved in the United States by these programs aren't overwhelmed by increasing emissions in the major developing country.
Very, very good point.
Yeah, and I'd like to also add that there are things that the individual can do, you know, use energy more efficiency. Really, putting airs in your tire does matter. I know Barack got a lot of grief for that, but it does matter. Energy efficient homes also are really important. Like Sarah, I'd like to encourage everybody to get involved in the legislature this year. It's House Bill 653.
And just a simple call to your legislator saying, I support this and I want you to also.
That helps.
Makes a difference.
Or visit them. Our legislators are very accessible. You could come down to the roundhouse and meet them and talk to them. You can show up at committee hearings and state your position. And if anybody has any questions about this bill or how to track this bill, they can call me. My phone number is 827-0351. I'd be happy to answer anybody's questions.
And that's Sandra Ely of the Environment Department of New Mexico. Jim Norton, you've got the last word.
Well, thank you. And I just wanted to assure all the listeners that your government here, under the leadership of Governor Richardson, is doing all we can in order to address this issue. And it's a really serious one. It's a very important one. And we need the help from all the listeners out there in order to solve the problem.
Jim Norton is the director of the Environmental Protection Division at the New Mexico Environment Department, and he's chair of the Western Climate Initiative Reporting Committee. Sandra Ely is the Environment and Energy Policy Coordinator for the New Mexico Environment Department. Sarah Cottrell is the Energy and Environmental Policy Advisor for Governor Richardson. And David Tunderman is an environmental lawyer with Parsons, Bailey, and Latimer in Salt Lake City. Thank you all so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org by email or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc and Sean Conlon for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience.